Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Briony Norrington is a multi-award winning North Australian author who grew up in the Burunga community in Arnhem Land, writing for children and adults in both fiction and non-fiction. The novel, A Piece of Red Cloth, was written in collaboration with three Yolngu cultural custodians. Welcome, Leonie, to Imagining the Past.
Hello. This is a great chance to be able to talk to you on the radio. It's good.
So I usually start by asking people, when did you first start writing and what was it exactly that drew you to writing?
My writing was a bit dictated. I did a journalism degree and once I started writing pieces and my Aboriginal mum said to me, "Hey, I know, you need to write some stories for our kids." And so I wrote a few short stories for them, for the kids, you know, for the schools, because in remote communities at that time, there was absolutely nothing about the children's lives, about how they live. They were all stories from elsewhere. And so I wrote a few little stories about hunting and fishing and about, you know, grandma taking you out bush when you don't want to go out bush and, you know, you'd rather be on your phone or something. And they were so celebrated that we continued working, my Aboriginal mum and I, on a whole series of them. And that turned into the Burumbi Kids, which was published about 20 years ago. And then was turned into a television series a couple of years ago. So it's been very successful.
Well, lovely. And,
that was good. So that's how it started. I was always really good at telling lies when I was a child. So my imagination worked quite well. So writing novels and creating stories is something I absolutely love doing. I've just continued. I've wrote some gardening books and I worked in journalism in gardening for a while, and then, but creating stories is my great love. I love that feeling when you are like in a daydream, you think of something and these characters are just doing their stuff in your mind and you just have to chase them along and try and write them down as fast as you can. The editing is not, I'm not the best editor in the world, but that part where you're chasing the characters along and all of these wonderful things are happening in your whole world, whether you're cooking or cutting down a tree or no matter what you're doing, that story is in your mind and part of who you are. And I often sort of forget that they're fictional characters, not real ones. I do get very immersed in it. I love it.
So have you always lived in Arnhem Land?
No, I was born in Darwin, and my dad, in the 1960s, a lot of Aboriginal people were hunted up and put onto communities It was during the assimilation era. And at that time, they were looking for people to work on those communities who could speak a bit of language and could and had had good relationships with Aboriginal people. And my dad grew up in Darwin, and he used to be fishing all the time with the people who lived there, the Larrakia people. And so he felt that this was something that he would be able to do. And so he took, there were 9 children in my family, and he thought that a community life might be a lot easier with a lot of kids too, because you could just run around in the bush rather than getting into trouble in town. And so he took us out in the 60s to Barunga, which is south of Katherine. And when we arrived there, I think the Aboriginal people who owned the country were a bit worried about, you know, 9 little white kids who had no knowledge of country being around on their own. And actually at that time it was policy for people, because people are the land and someone has to be responsible for their actions on the land. It was policy for Aboriginal people to adopt families. And then they would be responsible to teach the kids, to teach the adults, to tell them what's okay to do and what's not okay to do. And then they would be responsible to the land for your actions. It was, something that was very important to them. So we were adopted, because there were so many of us. We were adopted by one of the most important ceremony men at the time, a song man, and his youngest wife, who didn't have any children at the time. And that was Clara. And she was a fierce, fierce young woman, I can tell you. If you didn't listen, she had to tell you 2 or 3 times, doosh, you got a good whack. It was we were very lucky. We hunted and fished and walked in the bush all the time.
So how old were you when this happened, when you moved there?
I think I must have been about 6 or 7. And
wow.
I stayed there till I was about 13.
Wow, that's an amazing, clearly it has had an amazing impact on your life and the trajectories of your life.
Yeah, absolutely, it has. It growing up in 2 cultures, I think, is a really humbling way to grow up, especially when the dominant culture is not your culture, because you always feel, not in a bad way, but you always feel that you don't quite know what's happening. You don't feel confident in the world. And I think in a way that's quite good for a writer, because you absorb so much more when you don't feel confident, and you notice so much more when you're not sure of what's going on. And the trouble is that I, you know, go to meetings, or I'll be catching up with family, playing cards or something. And everyone presumes that I do know, because I grew up on country. And half the time I don't. Half the time I'm like, oh, but what does this mean in real terms? And, you know, it's very complicating, but it's good. I love it.
So did you grow up with language? You learnt their language?
Creole. At that time, there were maybe 5 different language groups all brought in together to the same community. And so although many people could speak each other's languages, they most often used Creole. My Aboriginal dad was Māori, and so we learnt quite a few Māori words, and he always spoke to us in Māori. He didn't speak to us in English at all. He'd speak to my dad in English, but he would speak to us mostly in Māori. And my Aboriginal mum was Yolngu, so she spoke to us in Yolngu a lot, although mostly in Creole.
And are those languages very, very different, or are they dialects of one another?
No, they're completely different.
Right.
Absolutely. They're as different as English is to German, or Swiss is to, completely different. I'm not a linguist, but there are quite a few languages which are not dialects of each other, but which come from the same root. And then there's other languages like Anandiliakwa and Wumboi, which are completely different, which have absolute, you know, they're like Finnish or Korean set with amongst these other languages that are connected together. Very, very different. And often people identify themselves and the way they are with the land when the ancestors actually created the land, not created, but when the land was created during that time, the land, the people, the stories and the language was all created at the same time. So each time a place was made, it had its own language, its own people, its own stories.
So is that the fact that there were distinct languages in a, like, you know, a relatively small area, really, you know, when you compare it to Europe or something, which has got different languages stamped across it, is that a reflection of the isolation of the people prior to, you know, modernity, for want of a better word?
No, they definitely weren't isolated, definitely, right. From each other.
Yeah.
Or from the rest of the world.
Yeah, like normally when people are in contact with one another, you know, their languages intermingle. Like it's a very easy mark of that integration of communities.
I think it's more to do with the fact that people understood themselves, and this is just my opinion. I'm not an anthropologist, but people tend to be very proud of their language and their country. And I think, you know how the English sort of have their different dialects and how they hang on to their dialects. I think people deliberately held on to their language that was given to them, that came to them at the beginning. And they held on to that deliberately. People could speak seven languages. You know, most people could speak three or four languages. They spoke their mother's language, their father's language, a trade language, and the languages of the people around them. But they definitely weren't isolated from each other. People walked, 1,000 kilometres, especially lawmen, but people walked huge distances in their own country and following the songs and the things. But for ceremonies, you know, men, big ceremony men, could walk 1,000 kilometres in a year, going from one ceremony to another. People knew what was happening in the rest of the country. There was trade all the way from the Kimberleys all the way to the centre, and the same from Yongol, you know. They definitely weren't isolated within Australia or with the rest of the world. I mean, the Macassar trade was happening for who knows how long. When the archaeologists did their first tests on the fire pits of the Macassans, they came back with evidence that they'd been there for 1,000 years. And of course, people thought, oh, that seems a bit silly. I don't know whether to believe it or not. But the trade in the early days in Indonesia, people lived on their boats, whole families lived on their boats, traveling and trading. And in Yongol stories, they talk about these Baini people that came down with their families and traded. They didn't trade for trepang at that time. That wasn't a huge thing, but they traded for tortoise shell and gold and sandalwood and ironwood was a very, because the iron that wood that we have here is really dense and hard and fabulous timber. And so they traded all these different things, pearls, tortoise shell and pearl shell. Yeah. And it wasn't until sort of the 1600s that when the Dutch had taken over Indonesia and were in control of the trade and they wanted to sell then to China, the trepang, that people started, big fleets of ships started coming down and trading for trepang. That was towards the 1600s and 1700s.
So you've mentioned some of your other books, which are obviously quite varied. Is A Piece of Red Cloth your first historical fiction?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So where did this fabulous idea for A Piece of Red Cloth come from?
Well, it came again from my Aboriginal mum. She had, as she got older, you know, she wasn't able to move around the country as easily. So she used to sit and watch a lot of television. And she was furious all the time about the way that especially traditional Aboriginal people were portrayed on the television. They were always portrayed as victims. They were never portrayed as victors. And, you know, she would go on and on and on and on about this. And she said to me, "You've got to write a book. You've got to write a book that shows the true history of Australia, not the Captain Cook one." She wanted a book that was set before white people came to Australia. And because she's young, all this story of the Macassans is very strong in her family and her life. And I had heard the story from the time that I was a little kid, all through, you know, about a girl getting kidnapped. And, you know, when you were a kid, it was a little kid, it was the story of beware of strangers, beware of, you know, people who might come. And then as I got older, then it became more important to talk about women's vulnerability, you know, when I was a teenager and everything. So the story was told in a different way, but I'd heard the story many times. And we both thought that that story would be one that would be really captivating for people. And so we sat down together and we wrote a bit of an outline of how the story might go. What were the important things that she really wanted in it? And then she died. And so for about 10 years, the story just sat and waited until her family got back in touch with me. And, you know, my brothers and sisters, we started talking about it. And my brother, who's just died recently, he said, "You've got to finish that story for Mum. You know, it's got to be, this is what she really wanted doing, so we should do it." And so I said, without her though, you know, we could have gone to Arnhem Land and she had all the contacts and she would have seen her family and it would have been much easier. But without her, it was really difficult to try and find people. There's nobody wants to talk to you over the phone. The fact that I'd written the Barumbi Kids and all of those stories that everybody knew and loved, I could get to talk to somebody on the phone, but they all just said, "No, come out. And, you know, it's 1,000 kilometres drive or 600 kilometres drive on really rough bush roads. So anyway, I did. I went out to Noombawar, which is where she grew up, and met some people and some people said, yeah, we'll work with you because we've got the connection. I own this country. This is where that story was told. I'm connected to your mum's family by this and this and this." And so they were the right people to talk to. And so we further developed the story. We started working on chapters and that was fantastic. But look, everyone who lives along the coast of Arnhem Land owns this story. I mean, there were many, many young girls kidnapped. And so everyone has this story and everyone owns it. And so as the story started to become more like a manuscript, I needed to go to all of the places and all of the people and talk to them and say what I wanted to do and, you know, who I was, how I was connected to the story and see if they were okay about me writing it. And so I travelled to lots of different communities along the coast and especially the communities which would be identifiable in the book. And then when I got to Yirrkala, I this very, very strange experience. Every morning, my totem is black cockatoo. And every morning I would come out of my house and walk down to the sea and back again. And every morning there was a flock of black cockatoos that followed me all along the, you know, going from the power lines. And I felt really welcomed and good about how this project was going to go. But after a week, nobody I contacted had got back to me. And I thought, "Oh, okay, you're not doing your job, boys." But I continued on. I was there for a month 3 weeks into that month, I still hadn't heard back from the people that I needed to talk to. And this one morning, I walked along and the black cockatoos were all there, and then they flew ahead of me and they all were sitting, you know, next to and in a puddle, and the puddle was outside of the art centre. And they kept sort of hopping and playing, and I was standing there watching them. And this lady sung out to me, and I went over and spoke to her. And she said, "Who are you?" And I told her who I was and how I was connected to the story and what I was doing. And she looked at me and she just laughed her head off. She said, "Your mother, my big sister who's dead now, that's my sister. I'm the person you need to talk to." It was just the most incredible experience. Anyway, we met and we had cups of tea and we talked, and the next day everyone, she must have talked to everyone and said who I was and how I was connected. And next day all the meetings came together. But it turned out then, this is the book is probably in its second full draft. It turned out then that everyone got together after I'd left and gone home and had permission and read the story to people. They all contacted me again and said, "But the story needs to change because you've got the story set and the people who are looking after the story are from Noongar. It has to change to Yolngu country. It has to, all the language words have to change. And the land has to change because your mum was a Yolngu woman from here. And the reason she ended up in Noongar was because when the cattle people came in, they brought with them, this is in the 1800s, into Arnhem Land, they brought with them shooters, and they just shot every Aboriginal person that they could see, just shot them all. And so my Aboriginal mum's father said, "We can't live on the country anymore. We have to move south and we have to go to the mission where we'll be safe." And so that's how she ended up at the mission and growing up there at Noongar. But her country was in the north. And so the story had to be set in her country because that's my direct relationship to the story, is through her and her country. So it was quite a fascinating experience. It was it was good then, though, because we, as I was reading the story, people would say, no, we don't do it that way. We do it this way. So you change that. And then it was a lot of backwards and forwards. I did it as a PhD project. And thank goodness I did it as a PhD project, because it was, the consultation was very long and would have been very expensive for me to do without an income. But the university was able to help, you know, with travel and expenses to get out there. And
wow, that's a story in itself.
Yes, that was a bit long, wasn't it?
No, I didn't mean that at all. It's just, you know, we all set off on these projects and think, oh, well, you know, it's going to take me 2 years to do this or something. And I mean, your project was obviously a lot longer than that. So you've said that in writing this, it was based a lot in oral traditions. So when I started thinking about the novel, I realized that I really didn't have much of a grounding or an understanding of what an oral tradition exactly is. So could you tell us a little bit about the oral tradition and how these stories and when these stories are retold and who kind of has the authority to tell those stories?
Well, people work out the authority each generation. Who's the person who, and nowadays a lot of it has to do with who's got the most time, who's got the knowledge, and who's able to tell the story. They have to be connected back to the family. And of course, every story has a person who is the manager of the story and a person who is considered the owner of the story. And of course, then, because each story is tied to a dreaming track, everybody along that dreaming track has the authority to talk about that story and criticize someone for talking about that story. So the stories are owned in multiple ways. And these things are just talked about all the time. To have a ceremony for, you know, some kind of Macassan story, everybody is negotiated with. They're very, it's a wonderful process, I think. It's totally different to the way people think of stories in European or Western culture. We kind of, I think the laws about stories in Western culture came about because once the printing press started to be available, you needed to have someone to blame. You needed to be able to punish someone for saying the wrong thing. And so the person who tells the story is the person who can be punished. And so that's how copyright law works. But copyright law in Australia is quite difficult because you can't have real recognition of Yong will say copyright because copyright can't be owned by a clan. It has to be owned by an individual. And that individual's, the way it goes to the next individual is not something that's negotiated each time. And when stories are told, they're told for a specific time. They're not necessarily told in exactly the same way and not necessarily by the same people. It's a negotiation of how this story can be told right now and for what purpose. So when somebody is painting, normally the Macassan story is told in dance and song and painting, huge amounts of beautiful paintings. And the reason that people agreed or wanted me to tell a story in this specific way as a historical novel is because they felt that it was difficult for Western educated people to understand the full story from a painting or from a song that's in a language they don't understand. So this story is specifically written. They've approved this story to be specifically written for that purpose so that the rest of Australia, the Western educated part of Australia, knows the story. It's another form. And one thing I did worry about was that this, A Piece of Red Cloth, as a novel, a historical novel, might end up being the kind of official, you know, story. And it's not. It's a very specific purpose. It's the purpose is so Western educated people can understand that story. Everyone else has, in fact, one of their old men that I worked with said to me, because I was saying to him, you know, the story will be fantastic. We can do a picture book and the kids can have it at school. And he said, no, we have this story. The children already have this story. We paint it, we sing it, we talk about it. This story you're writing is for Western educated people. He was very clear about that.
So when these stories are told, I'm just thinking back to, I mean, it's interesting you brought up the printing press and the changes that obviously happened with stories, Western stories then, because prior to that, stories were forwarded or maintained through poetry or through verse forms, which aided in the memory of the story. And also I think a lot of stories were handed on because the language of those stories was just so beautiful. Is that kind of part of yours, of that story tradition, that the actual manner the story is told and the language the story is told with, that they aid the memory and the handing on the story?
Yes, I believe so. And when I was talking to people on one of the islands, because that's another part of, in the book that, you know, people from that island who own that country are involved. The old man who owned the story, he was at a young man ceremony. And that young man ceremony was, you know, an hour and a half away on a dirt road. And every day he drove that hour and a half to come and talk to me and the children about this Macassan story. And then, you know, an hour and a half back, it was so important that the children and I understood the real story. And so, first of all, he talked about the paintings with the children. And then they sang songs. And then one day he organized everyone to come and they did this unreal corroboree, which was the story. And of course, the children could understand the language. I couldn't understand the language, but the children could understand the language. And there were parts in it where they were killing themselves laughing and parts in it when it was really sad. And it was this fantastic corroboree. And once when we were walking along, he was telling the story about how Yolngu people didn't become Makassan. So it's that story is told through the story of a dingo. And the Makassan says to the dingo, "You here, have these matches." And the dingo says, "No, I don't need your matches. I'll light the fire my own way." And he lights the fire with fire sticks. And continually, all the time, he's telling that same thing. So when the Makassan says, "Oh, you know, take this or do this or we can do that," or "No, we're Yolngu. We do not need to do things your way. We do them our own way." And as he's telling that story, we're walking along the beach where the story happened, where the dingo and the Makassan met. And as we're walking along the beach, he changes from one language to another, because this is how the story is told in this language. And then as it moves to the next language group, it's told the same story, but in a different language. It was the most amazing thing. And one thing that I thought was very interesting for my, you know, Western educated brain was that I read quite a lot of anthropological documents and recordings and about this story. And when he took us to the stones to tell, you know, a specific story, it was almost word for word exactly the same, the story that his grandfather had told this anthropologist, and it was recorded. It was,
oh wow,
you know, that's two or three generations down and the story's still exactly the same, told in the same sort of rhythms and in the same words. And yes, very interesting experience.
So this is the first novel that we've had on the podcast which has been written by more than one author. So a piece of red cloth cites four authors. I'm just wondering how that all worked on a practical level.
And there were many other, there were about probably 100 people involved. And the reason that those three people are specifically on the cover is because they worked on the final edit, but also they're the owners of the story. So I think that's the most important thing, is the stories, as I said before, the story and the people and the country emerge at exactly the same time. So the people are the story and the country. So people don't own story in you know, the copyright kind of Australian way of understanding it. They are the story. And how it actually worked was that I read, because people who don't speak English find it, don't speak English all the time, find it, you know, hard and annoying to have to read great tracts of English. And so I read the story onto a recording and people listened to it. And then they rang me and said, you know, and incredible memories. Like, you know, if I listened to a story, I wouldn't be able to remember word for word, but they're sitting there on the phones and going, you know where it says did, 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 did? Well, I reckon you should put in this and this and this. And this is a good opportunity to have somebody doing turtle hunting or whatever. The input was pretty amazing.
I think a lot of films now are written by a committee, and unfortunately I think the accountants are often on the writing committee, so it probably explains why a lot of films go wrong. But But also now we've got this popular form of these long, incredibly long series that are, you know, 8 hours a series. So there has to be more than one writer. So I'm just wondering if there were kind of issues with working with all of these people that came up that you had to resolve, you know, how did you kind of get around those things of just having so many people with so much input?
I think because most of the people that I work with have worked with Western educated people most of their lives, they know how to deal with us. So they make a decision amongst themselves and then tell you what they want done.
Right.
And all of them really understood stories. Even though they don't read historical fiction, they know how stories work. So there was never really a situation where they wanted me to do something that wasn't going to work in the story. And any kind of situation where I wanted to put in something that people didn't agree with, I just didn't put it in.
Mm.
Because ultimately, it's their story. I'm the person who's, you know, putting the ink on the paper.
Transcribing more than.
Yeah, and it's more than transcribing because stories, oral stories are not told in the same way. It's an interpretation, I suppose, more than a transcription. But then I think that the most important thing is that the story is told how the people who were in it, you know, I think one of the things that we don't think about enough as authors is how we represent other people. We've had free rein, really, to represent the rest of the world as we see it. And I don't know that I agree with that. I think that most, because as authors, we are unofficial historians. We are unofficial commentators. And often we're talking about lives we've never lived, people we don't know that much about. Whether it's a person talking about, you know, a family that's in crisis or we imagine, but we can only imagine within our own understanding of the world. I think we've, especially poor people or lower class, can you say, people are often subjects of fiction or and victims of fiction often. You read it and you go, whoa, this is, you're representing these people. How would they feel about it? So I feel very strongly about that. And I think with Indigenous people, it's probably even more important because most people don't meet many, especially remote community Indigenous people in their lives. They read about them a lot in newspapers, in articles, and often that is derogatory. So when you're writing an Indigenous person in your fiction, you have to be really, really sure, because you know that this is going to colour people's opinions. You have to be really sure that this is how they, the people that you're talking about, want to be represented. That's what I think anyway. And also, you know, if I did represent people in a not very nice light, somebody would come after me, I can tell you that. What did you say this about us for?
I think the opening chapter is really stupendous. Like, it illustrates all the strata and the protocol of life so kind of effortlessly, really. And to a non-Indigenous reader, it's not alienating either. I didn't feel like I was entering a world that I didn't understand. It kind of constructed and explained the world at the same time. But it also kicked off the story very economically, because the actual major drama is in that opening chapter as well, really. So I always think opening chapters are kind of the worst thing to write. They're really hard to kind of pull together. So I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about writing that opening chapter, and how long did it take, and did it take a lot of effort to bring it together?
Yes, it definitely took a lot of effort. It was something that the first draft of that I wrote very early on, because there was always this idea that Aboriginal Australians were able to protect themselves if they wanted to from the rest of the world. That people understand that. That's why it was difficult for people to find Australia. People just understand that they protected themselves. And I was working through this idea of the shield, and so that first chapter was something that came fairly early on in the piece. But I did first of all start the novel off with Gudditjie's grandmother sitting on the sand dunes and looking out to sea. But then I realised towards the end, and actually it was a friend of mine who said, I think you need to have a snippet, four snippets, so that you get the four main characters right at the beginning, so that you can understand more about the structure of the story from that. And so that was when I wrote that piece. And the idea of the shield and the idea of what people had to do to move into the country didn't have to be imagined. I already knew that. So in a way, it was just imagining myself onto that boat and writing it. Do you often have readings? Because I could just read it if that wouldn't take up too much time.
Yeah, no, if you'd like to do that, that would be lovely, yeah.
Out in the Timor Sea, Abisu stands at the bow of the prow. He opens his arms and turns his face to the sky. The crew watch and wait. Theirs is the lead prow in a 60-strong fleet from the islands of the north, bound for Meragi, the great southern land. Meragi is invisible. Only Abisu can expose it. Bisu Susula faces the horizon. You are impatient today, he tells the wind, and motions to the commandant to lower the sail. They must not run aground on Amber Islands. His grandfather captured slaves from Amber. He had no choice. They had a quota to fill for the Portuguese, and the tribesmen would not sell their kin. But the slaves refused to live without their country, and they jumped overboard before they reached Timor. Now the tribesmen kill anyone who runs aground on Amber Islands, no exception. The Bisu brings his thoughts back to the present. He closes his eyes and breathes deeply to still his mind. The chant begins in his chest. It is like a moan at first, but it swirls, builds, lifts itself into the air and spreads out across the ocean, calling to the stone and earth of Murungi. Behind him wait 60 prows, 30 men in each, their breath tight in the chest. Behind his eyelids, colours float like ribbons across his vision. Pink, green, purple, red. Red becomes dominant and then ochre. There! He focuses on the ochre and builds from memory piece by remembered piece the battered cliffs of red stone, the white beaches, the mangrove forests. He opens his eyes and squints. He can see a faint red haze on the horizon. Bisu Susula lifts his hand and signals, first holding his fingers apart to show the distance and then pointing to indicate the direction. Hoist the sail, Commandant yells. Southeast! The lead prow turns and shouts ring out as each Nakoda orders his crew to turn rudders and raise sails. The prows move past Amber Islands and by and by the dull red rocky cliffs of Murungi show themselves. Is this Murungi? Uncle, a young man asks the Bisu, staring terrified at the barren, dry land. Not a tree, a bird, a movement, just red, hot stone. Don't be alarmed, the Bisu said. It's a trick played on your eye. The shaman of Murungi are very skilled. Are they dangerous? They are powerful, his uncle says, but their power keeps my position secure, and yours too if you walk in my footsteps. He drops his voice, looking around to make sure no one is listening. Now that King Wandeng has accepted the one god of the Arabs, he says, refusing to call the king by his new name, Sultan Aladdin, he will support the Muslim captains. the merchants also favour them because they are righteous and work hard for profit. But the Muslim nakodas cannot find the Marangi. While the shaman of Marangi are strong, a bisu must always lead the fleets who search for Trupang in Marangi. Fly the fails, Commandant yells, and the bisu's nephew climbs up the tripod masts and sets the sumo bisu flags flying. High above the prow, the young man can see beyond the red cliffs into the endless, barren interior. The dryness makes him feel hollow inside.
Beautiful. Lovely. Thank you for that. It's, yeah, it's such beautiful images. And as I said, it really starts to illustrate the whole setup of the novel. So it's very well done. So my pronunciation, I think, is going to be very bad, but I did make an effort to try and learn this very difficult word. So you've mentioned that you used a lot of made up Yolngu. That was the pronunciation. Is that right? Yolngu?
Yes. Yolngu.
Yolngu. How?
Yolngu.
Yolngu.
Ngu.
No. Some Yolngu
words. It's hard for our tongues to get around, isn't it?
And you've even used some Makassan words. So was there a risk of kind of alienating the reader by using these words that people were not familiar with?
Well, this was a discussion that we had, and in Numbawa, when I was working with people in Numbawa, there's the lady that I was working with is Jango Nundribala, and she said she's a linguist. And her sisters, she's a translator and a linguist, and her sisters works as a linguist with linguists as a linguist. And they killed themselves laughing when I said, should we have, you know, lots of language words in the book? Will it make people work too hard? And she said, they all killed themselves laughing. And they said, it's good for them to work too hard. And exactly the same thing when I was working with Mediki, who is also a translator, and she's written books in English and also in language, and she teaches people language. And she said exactly the same thing. It's good for people to work hard. And I think I'm a reader who if there's a word that I... You know, I didn't come to reading very well until I was in my 20s. And so when I see a word that I don't know, I usually just brush over it. I never try and sound it out. I just take a picture of it in my mind of the pattern and just remember that that's that person. And I expect that anyone who finds language words difficult will probably do the same thing. And so deliberately, we decided to make people's names and places either really long words or short words so that you can see the pattern of them. And starting with different letters, there's an enormous amount of names in Yolngu which start with DJ or TJ or, you know, those kind of things. They're very, very similar. So we made up names that were still sounded like Yolngu words and could be spelt like Yolngu words, but were different shapes, different images. And we thought that would help. Hopefully it did. But we were very lucky to have a good friend who you know, grew up in a very urban Melbourne. And hadn't spent an awful lot of time on remote communities. And we did send, and she was a friend both of Mediki's and mine, and we sent chapters to her. And it was really good because she would go, oh, what? How does that work? And so then you could just use a few words to make the context clear. that was very helpful because, you know, for us it's obvious.
I'm probably going to trip over myself with this, but like one of the enduring notions I have of Indigenous culture is this connection and care for country, which, you know, I've got a sense of that within myself, I think. I would never presume to have the same. But it seems to me that pre-colonization, to have a notion of disrespect of the country is a bit odd because people were living with the country, and the disrespect came when colonization happened and people were, you know, putting cattle into water holes and things like that. In your novel, there's the arrival of metal and metal objects, which the Macassan bring with them. But you also talk about how people had been taught to actually extract metal from the earth and forge things out of that metal. So I'm just kind of wondering if you, in the novel, you were starting a discussion about that kind of coming, what I would call disrespect of the country by the colonizing forces.
Yes. It was something that was really important for one of the old men that I first worked with, because he said, you know, people say all the time to me, how come you never made the wheel? And he said, we didn't need to. You know, if we needed something, we would make it, but we didn't need to. And we did use iron. We did trade for iron. Iron was a good thing to use. And people went to Macassar, many people went to Macassar, and saw iron being created. But there was no way that they were going to use their country, which is actually them, to create the steel. I think that people were very specific about that, especially the two old men that I worked with were very specific about whether you can, you know, you can use things that you trade, but to dig up your own country, which is yourself, and destroy it to make something that you can just trade for anyway, is okay. And that was something that especially the old man from Numbawa, he was very, you know, we sat down where the men have that big ceremony and they talk about that. That was something that that he really wanted done. And he probably set out those chapters, you know, in conversation with him, we actually set out those chapters. And he felt a bit funny about me being a woman, but I was in the right relationship to, like, my relationship to the story was a managerial role, and so he could, you know, forgive me for being a woman. Because there's absolutely nothing in that book that is secret or sacred, or even refers to secret, sacred stuff. It's all children's knowledge. It's all knowledge that I, you know, had by the time I was 13. It's not, you know, that's been checked over and over and over again by I've read the story to that many people, and they're all very happy that it has no knowledge. At one point we talk about a women's ceremony, and a women's ritual, really, where women go up and they celebrate the yams. But none of that is secret. The patterns, the actual drawings, are secret and sacred. The words are secret and sacred, but not the action, not the fact that they do it. So, and that was something that I think is really important, that respecting those things. Well, I was just told what to do, so it wasn't me respecting in a way. It was, but acknowledging that is inside information, not outside information, that people hold close to them. And people, you know, I don't think Western readers would understand how it works anyway. Most Western readers won't understand how it works. I certainly don't. So it was just a matter of checking over and over and over again that it didn't touch on any words or any actions that were inside actions.
So you've kind of talked about this a little bit, but I'm just kind of wondering about the process of once you got drafts finished that everyone was kind of happy with, how much kind of effort did you then put into, you know, getting it into a Western kind of storytelling form? Because, you know, clearly you've said the book was written for a Westerner, so, or a Western educated person. So how much effort did that take to get it into its final form?
Well, I wrote it as a historical novel right from the beginning. So it was always in that Western form. With some people, I had to tell them the story, you know, because reading, listening to pages and pages and pages of something in English is quite a ridiculous and difficult thing to do. But if you know where the story's going, and then you can just, you know, if you know how that chapter's going to go, and then you can listen to you know, 15 minutes or 10 minutes of somebody reading it to you. But most people knew that that's what it was right from the beginning. It was a Western story. It was written in a specific way. And so they were listening to it in that. We did have, there were a lot of edits afterwards, but they weren't adding any new information. They were editing my terrible writing. They were, you know, spelling mistakes and structural errors, and I don't understand this bit, and, you know, maybe you need to elaborate more on this. There's any time that we needed to elaborate, we actually had to change the ending of the story because initially I had her Gutterji actually being taken away, because I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to have her story set in Indonesia with her? But, and that was an that was accepted. But then after about 6 months, people had thought about it and talked about it, and there had been a few ceremonies where, you know, Macassan kind of stories, collective stories that had happened, and people came back to me and said, no, I don't, we want her captured. We want her to be, we want the Yolngu characters to be victorious, complete. And so we changed the ending to what it is now. But no, it was always going to be a historical novel for that purpose of teaching Western educated people about Yolngu, you know, life with the Macassans and before with traders from the north.
So you're actually speaking to us today from Furuna in the Blue Mountains behind Sydney. What are you working on now? What's the next project?
Well, there's in the Northern Territory, the Buffaloes came into the Northern Territory with an army base in North Australia about 200 years ago, nearly exactly 200 years ago. And they've spread across Arnhem Land, and Aboriginal people have been severely impacted, and they were 90% of the workforce for every industry based on buffalo hunting and buffalo catching in that 200 years. But stories about buffalo hunters are most often told in historical fiction and also in, you know, memoir by big white buffalo hunters. The story of the Indigenous people who did all the work hasn't been told. And after I worked with people about a piece of red cloth, And you know, that news sort of spread across Arnhem Land. There were quite a few people who said, we should tell, you work with me and I'll tell you this, tell the story of us mob in the buffalo hunting, not them. And so I'm working on that at the moment. It's I'm working with some rangers, and it may turn into a novel. It may not. I don't know. But at the moment, it, just collecting the history is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And just the fact that when the buffalo came in, they destroyed in the areas where they were and where they overpopulated, they destroyed 70% of people's food. Just like that. And so therefore people were forced to go and work for flour, because they, you know, all their flour was gone. Just these fascinating stories.
So if it does take form, it will be an historical novel, or will it be in present?
No, I think it'll be a historical novel, yes.
I'd like to thank you very much for your time today. You've been very generous, and I've enjoyed our chat, and I really enjoyed the novels.
Thank you very much, and good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.